Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country tonight or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become than you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. And welcome to X Squared Radio. Tonight is Super Bowl Sunday, so I understand if you're not listening live. You could turn the sound down on the game, not on the commercials, of course, but on the game, and you could listen to the broadcast live tonight. That would be cool. The solar wind is 513 kilometers per second, and the proton count is only 0.6 protons per cubic meter. And I think that this may be the lowest we have ever seen on this program since we began reporting this to you about 5 years ago. On Super Bowl Sunday, for the first time ever, NASA's STEREO spacecraft moved into position to photograph the entire sun, front and back. Researchers say this is a transforming moment in solar physics that could lead to big advances in space weather forecasting. I think predicting Earth weather is getting better, don't you? Let's hope it doesn't take that long to get good at predicting solar weather. One bad solar tsunami could really harsh our electronic gig down here. And I've often thought about just firing the weatherman because I don't really like the weather lately. I don't know anybody that does. I got part of the program tonight. We're going to talk about weather anomalies. And as it relates to a pole shift, sort of last year or so, not really been that hot in the news, but wow, lately, since all of the ecological symptoms seem to be lining up with some chaos in Earth's magnetic field, it has become of high interest lately. Lots and lots of press about it, lots and lots of documentaries on TV about it, and certainly a lot of YouTubes on it. Just for the heck of it, I went back and looked at the YouTubes that we posted for the Horizon Project when we produced it back in 2008. And some of those YouTubes have been viewed over 14 million times. So it is of high interest to a lot of people. Recently, reports of pulsating auroras have increased. Reports of pulsating auroras go back more than a century, but until recently, no one knew what made the aurora borealis behave like a strobe light. Researchers from UCLA solved the puzzle in 2009, early 2010, using data from NASA's Themis spacecraft. Some of them call it Themis. Of course, the project leaders always mispronounce the names of their own projects. Anyway, they discovered that auroras pulse in sync to chorus waves, what they call them, in Earth's magnetosphere. This is a type of plasma wave that seems to be able to modulate the flow of solar wind particles down to Earth during geomagnetic storms. Other researchers call this a Christ grid, or they call it a Merkaba grid around the Earth. These are fixed lines of juxtapositions around the planet, sort of like a diamond-shaped spider web. And these lines are connected to the large mountains, which are points of high gravity on the planet, and that this is sort of acts like a screen or a sieve to magnetic waves, especially solar magnetic waves that come to the Earth. So this pulsating, this strobing, may actually just be the strings of the fabric of this
screen over the Earth that, because the Earth is rotating and this grid is fixed to the Earth during that rotation, it's sort of flashing the light as it passes in front of it. And you know that tonight is the night of the Super Bowl. We expected it to be a drug event. No, not that kind of drug event. I mean that Pittsburgh was going to get drug up and down the field. What I suggest is that you turn the sound down on the game, except for the commercials, that is. That's the interesting part. And listen to tonight's broadcast, because we only have 3 hours. And I want to make sure that you don't miss anything. If you have the opportunity to listen to it live, just, you know, set up your iPhone or your computer and listen to the broadcast and watch the game. By the way, if you want to listen to tonight's broadcast live on your cell phone, all you have to do is call 712-432-0075, 712-432-0075, and then dial the access code 318-116-pound. If you'd like to be part of the program tonight, and I suggest that you do this, we have new listeners in Taiwan, in Turkey, in Australia, in Wales. We even had a contact from Sri Lanka this week. So lots and lots of listeners out there listening to the program, and we appreciate you. If you want to call in, you can do so at 530-413-4511 or 530-413-4515. And those numbers should roll over if you hit one and it happens to be busy. So keep trying, and we will get everyone on, I promise. As you're putting your survival kit together, and I suggest that you do so, we've now early in the season for storms, we have now had one of the longest-reaching snowstorms in history in the United States. At one time already, twice this year, we've had 48 states covered with snow at the same time. That's really something, and we're going to cover a little bit more of that as we get deeper into the program. But as you're putting that survival kit together, and I recommend that you do so for your car, your office, and have one at the house or the apartment or the condo that you live in. Even if you're renting, you can do this. Because these supplies are very compact, well-packaged, well-priced, and free shipping by visiting our friends at 1-800-PREPARE.com, 1-800-PREPARE.com. And as you check out, put in my name, Brooks, B-R-O-O-K-S. You'll get an extra 10% off. And our friends in New York, Paul Faust, former firefighter who survived 9/11, saw a great need to put together a preparedness site where people could go. They didn't know anything about putting a kit together, didn't know anything about what had to be, what is a basic essential, what is a great value in equipment that you might need for an emergency. They put it together for you. And the prices are great. The shipping is awesome. The quality is amazing. I have bought some myself. When it comes, you're just amazed. Even the bag that it comes in is designed to last 25 years without any maintenance at all. So you get water, food, compass, FM radio, AM radio, flashlight, whistle, all kinds of food and medical devices and things that will help you survive. Now, the reason that you want this is so that you don't become a burden upon emergency services, as they, I'm sure, have been burdened by, during this recent snowstorm, tens of thousands of people who did not listen to this program and who did not get prepared. Even the most basic things they did not have. The other part of your preparedness we have suggested in the book, which is now still an Amazon bestseller, and Barnes & Noble is now putting it in their bookstores. So we're moving up the ladder. Remembering the Future, the Physics of the Soul and Time Travel, is being heralded as a self-help book with a Renaissance twist.
We like that. That's got all the pieces to it. Yes, you will do some time travel in the book. Yes, there's a little bit of math, but it's simple and it's there to help you understand the relationships between your energy and the energy of the universe and how you can make it function for yourself, for good or for evil, if that's what you desire to do. Mine is not to prevent you from reaching your dream, but to facilitate that by writing this book. The meditation that is suggested in the book is there to help you learn to listen to the universe, because with your dream or your intention, you're going to thump it. You're going to start the bell ringing. But if you're too busy doing other stuff, if you're all buried in the noise and chaos of day-to-day life, you can't hear it when it comes back around. You cannot hear the effect of what you have done come back around, so you won't know what to do, when to act, when to apply your next intention on the universe. This meditation is for busy people. It's called the Flower of Life Meditation. Some also call it the Merkaba Meditation. Now, the Merkaba is much, much older than this form of meditation, but this is a meditation for busy people because it's basically exactly 17 breaths. Literally, from the time you walk in and sit down or assume whatever position you want to do when you're meditating, 17 breaths later and you're in. Now, that is a meditation for busy people. What I have done through my own research and discovery is I've added the 18th breath. Now, the 18th breath is rumored to be out there, but it is not published except by me. So this breath will allow you to maintain that state and allow you to reach levels of listening and skill and reaching out into the universe with your heart that you could never do before. And we teach you how to do the 18th breath. I highly suggest, after you read the book, after you order the audio CD from Maureen St. Germain, listen to it for about 4 to 6 weeks. You're going to get good at the meditation, but you're also going to be making some mistakes. So what I would highly recommend is that you sign up for a class from my teacher, Maureen St. Germain. I took my first class from the originator of the meditation, Drun Vallam Melchizedek. He's a little hard to get a class with. He is a global instructor, and he has lots of master teachers out there. Maureen is one, and one whom I recommend. So the link to her website is on rememberingthefuturebook.com. It is also on xradio.com. And I am suggesting that you find one of her very affordable training seminars. They're usually 2.5 days, a Friday, Saturday, and a Sunday. I highly recommend that you go. It's not a workshop high. It is a change of life. And that is, after all, what you're looking for, is it not? And I highly recommend it. I can tell you that it works, and I have the proof that it works. So this is my recommendation, MaureenStGermain.com. Click on the link at the website and find it for yourself. Okay, let's get started with this. We're going to have have your seatbelts on, right? Okay, just recline your chair, look out the window, you know the drill. We'll be back. 40 seconds. Don't go away. Okay, a few years ago, Brent Miller produced a video called The Kill Shot. Shortly after that, we corroborated on one of the world's most watched documentaries on the possibility of a pole shift called The Horizon Project. Since that time, thousands of studies and papers have been published trying to get the world prepared, and it won't be easy, because we're locked into a cycle of how many toys we can accumulate by the time we die. We're more concerned with health insurance than we are health care, and on and on. We have, by and large, still not realized that we are self-employed. And believe me, it doesn't matter who you work for. If you work for one of the Fortune 100 or if you work for a mom and pop, you are self-employed. You work for yourself. You are a business of yourself. And the sooner that you come to that realization, the sooner that you realize you are 100% responsible for your life condition, the better off you are. Yes, it's a shock. Oh, my goodness. Some people say, oh, no, no, I couldn't have done this to myself. There's no way. Yes, way. Absolutely, yes, way. That's why we wrote the book. That's why I want you to read it. We've had unbelievable response in the last, since October 25th, since the book went live. Lots of people in lots of countries have ordered the book. We've sold books this last week in Turkey, in Egypt, in Pakistan. Unbelievable where this book is going and what effects it's going to have in that region of the country. We could not be more pleased. Taiwan, other places where turmoil and struggle has gripped that region since they could write. Now this book is getting into that area, and hopefully the effects will be noticeable before too long. Now, a pole shift is a difficult subject to talk about because the evidence is so hotly contested on all sides. On the one extreme, geologists predict that the poles are wobbling and nothing more. They may move, but it may take many millennia to make significant change in the alignment of north and south on Earth. To hear Donald Morrison or David Morrison with NASA talk, everything is all right, everything is fine, go back to the mall. All of this is just a bunch of internet hype. People are out there making money off of it, and pay no attention to it. Everything is fine. Believe me, I'm from the government, and I'm here to help you. On the other extreme, there are those who cite evidence and make the case that we are perhaps 500,000 years overdue for a pole shift. And also that when they do occur, it happens at a very rapid rate, much more rapid than the normal slow as water eroding granite pace that normally clocks geological changes, sort of like wearing marble steps down with tourists walking on it. Even if you took time-lapse photography, you're going to have to stand around for a couple of hundred years to see that step be worn down by all the people walking up that section of the stairs. It's just a slow process. But in November of 2004, The Arc of Millions of Years, the first volume of the series, was published. And in that book, my co-author and I put about 200 summations and predictions that we published as a result of nearly 20 years of research my co-author and I had done on separate aspects of Earth changes. I took the scientific side of the support, and E.J. Clark took the archaeological side of the support. Now, you know, both of those are lifelong studies. And, you know, once you become very, very advanced in that science, you also get a very, very narrow scope. It takes quite a few years to develop a cross-thought, a cross-disciplinary thought, so that you can incorporate things like, well, let's say, for instance, archaeology and geology. Those are two completely separate sciences. They're in completely separate buildings. They have completely separate schools of thought and philosophies. And when a geologist says, hey, dude, you know, that clay that you're digging in right there, it's 350 million years old. So you can't tell me that what you're finding in there is only 10,000 years old. And the archaeologist says, well, you obviously don't know what you're talking about, because we know that toolmakers didn't live back then, that all we had were dinosaurs and giant butterflies back then. There were no humans. I'm glad you were there and are so convinced that you're right. Anyway, now you see that without this cross-disciplinary approach, you can't see it. It's like wearing sunglasses in a movie theater. You just don't see the evidence. So the book was a cross-disciplinary approach. It was about 560 pages, and it was the first of three that literally changed everything with respect to looking at 2012. All the rumor and innuendo and political Felder garb set aside, the facts were there. Together, these hitherto unrelated fields of study provided proof that certain things would happen. I mean really specific things, not general things. Like we predicted that the Afar Triangle at the edge of the Red Sea would tear open in a seismic event and fill in with the Red Sea. Within months of the book's publication, that exact event occurred and was eyewitnessed by a geological team that happened to be doing field work on that location. And, but for a waiting helicopter, they would have been killed. Approximately 30,000 years of erosion and geological movement took place in one afternoon. We said exactly that that would happen, and that is exactly what happened. No, we didn't manifest it. But we looked at the geological record, and we looked at the archaeological record, and the predictions that were made in scripture, in historical records, on scrolls, on plates, and that is what was predicted. And so we just put two and two together, two coming from the scientific side, two coming from the archaeological side, and we got four. And that's what we published, and that's what happened. Now, are we brilliant in doing this? Yes, of course we're brilliant in doing this. But what we did is we took the confusing, the extreme positions, and poured them together in the same glass, and what we got was a nice lukewarm answer that made sense, and the evidence began to back it up. So, this may seem very controversial to you, and it is, no question. That's okay. That's okay. If you have another opinion about it, any thoughts on it, any contributions, anything that's happened in your neck of the woods that you would like to share, we want you to call in and express your thoughts about it. So I'll give out the numbers again, 530-413-4511, 530-413-4515. No, they're not toll-free numbers. Somebody chatted, are these toll-free? No, they're not toll-free. But come on, who pays long distance anymore? Pick up your cell phone. It's a local call, okay? And besides, you're not going to stay on long anyway unless you really want to. You can come on for 2 minutes, make your point, get off, and listen to the answer because it may be prolific. So call in and express your feelings about this. Now, you know, we really have to look at this pole shift thing from three aspects, and I think that's what we're going to do in this hour. One, we'll talk about how fast a pole shift can occur, because this is really the gist of the argument. This is the level of fear that the politicians will throw at you. This is the level of apathy that the scientists will throw at you. So we really want to know how quick is this going to occur, really. I mean, is this going to get in the way of my summer vacation? Do I have to stop watching the Super Bowl now because the poll's going to shift? Those are the kinds of questions. What planning do I have to make? Like I was on an interview the other day, and we were talking just about this subject briefly. And someone said, well, you know, what should we do to prepare? I said, well, you know, one thing I would do, I'd move away from the beach. And the interviewer said, well, I live on the beach. I said, I would take a picture and pack, because the beaches are going to be washed away. And the interesting thing is we have about 80 to 90% of our population that lives within 20 miles of a coast.
And that includes the major rivers, of course, but still, we live next to water. Our power is distributed very close to water. Not so much out in flyover country, which is the areas, by and large, that are going to survive this. I would say anything above 800 feet above sea level and at least 20 miles away from the coast. I would say maybe 100 miles away from the coast, because the winds that are associated with what is going to happen could be as high as 300 miles an hour, and they could last for a month. So when we use the words hunker down, that's exactly what we mean. I don't think the entire planet is going to be bathed in that kind of wind, but there will certainly be corridors that can show that kind of wind. We've had winds very close to that high. We're only talking about wind, maybe 60% faster than a tornado. And we have now, of late, documented what's called straight-line storms. These are not rotating funnels that drop down out of the clouds at high speed. These are straight-line walls of wind that go marching across the tundra at 80 to 100 miles an hour. And they literally just act like a wind tidal wave. And they just knock everything over, rip roofs off. And I've been in one. I've been in two of them, one in Kansas and one in Kentucky, and saw it coming, because you could see everything in front of it being kicked up and not a cloud in the sky. I mean, just as clear a day as you can imagine. The most amazing place where this occurs is Washington State. Out in the eastern desert of Washington State, where they grow wheat, this is the most productive wheat-growing land on Earth. While the fields are dirt, the dirt shows up the currents of wind, because the dirt gets picked up by the wind, and it assumes, at least in concentration, in these rivulets of the air. Now, there's not a cloud in the sky, bright sunshine, 80, 90, 100 degrees outside, and yet you can see the currents of air because the dirt is being picked up by these million-acre farms where they grow wheat or sugar beets or potatoes, and packs it into those tight winds. And the strange thing is, you could pull your vehicle over, because it's if you've never seen it, it's quite stunning. It's like looking at another planet. You're looking out over basically barren rolling hills of dirt, and yet it looks like 10 to 20 dirt tornadoes with this dirt going up in the sky maybe 500 feet. And you take out your camera and set it up and take pictures, and for some reason it doesn't show up. What you can see with your eye, because your eye is a continuous sampling of what you're seeing, you can't get the instantaneous shot of it with a camera, at least the one that I had. I had a pretty good camera, but no filters to put on it. Maybe that's what I needed to get a picture of it. And I was so impressed by it, I may go back up this summer just to get those pictures, because it's quite stunning. It's something that will just catch your eye. But the point that I'm trying to make is these straight-line winds are now occurring almost as a regular basis. We hear about straight-line wind damage in states that were normally just plagued by tornadoes. These straight-line winds are developed by movements in the jet stream, like vibrations, like ripples, like sort of when you drop a pebble into a pond and the waves go out. That's what it looks like. These things, I mean, you've seen a dirt devil out in the playground when you're a kid. These are like gigantic dirt devils, huge, you know, maybe 10 feet across at the bottom and 500 feet high. I was erecting some steel, and one was coming literally right down the railroad tracks straight at me. I'm 30 feet in the air on top of some steel, screwing metal roofing down. I've got about 10 sheets of 20-foot-long steel sitting on the roof with me.
and I had to get a bucket to get up there. Well, there was no time to get down. So I just laid down as flat as I could on top of the steel and hoped it didn't pick the whole thing up and rip it out of the ground. Of course, it was bolted to the concrete, so I didn't think it was going to pick that up. Let me tell you, it was quite a ride. It was not like a tornado, but it was, you know, 60-mile-an-hour winds for about 5 seconds. That was really something. I've never seen anything like that before. And coming at you at, you know, 40 miles an hour, it's not not something you could just jump out of the way of. It's like being in a miniature tornado. So the second is we're going to talk about, remember the first one was we're going to talk about how fast a pole shift can occur. How quick is it going to occur? By halftime, you know, we better get out of here. No. Two, let's talk about what is actually going to happen. What is a pole shift? What actually happens? The movement of the magnetic flux around the Earth is redirected. Also, you know, what does that mean for the actual structure of the Earth? And three, we're going to talk about what the effects on life on Earth will be. I didn't say might be. The ecology of the Earth has the planet's magnetism woven right through the very fabric. If you pull that thread, the whole thing could come apart. Now, it could be put back together, and it most certainly will level out into some new ecology. The question is, what happens to the life cycle? By the life cycle, I mean there is a cycle of life from the bacterial level through the respiration cycle of plants, photosynthesis, all of that process, the metabolism of that plant material by other animals, those animals being consumed by other animals, even humans, and the plants and the animals being consumed by humans. What happens to the food chain? What happens to the disease cycle? What happens to bacteria that doesn't live very well in one ecology, and gratefully so, because we don't have an immunity to it, but would live very well in the new ecology? What kind of pandemic would be a result of that? So in going along with that, I'm going to play you a clip. Now, this clip is actually part of an Australian flood piece. And it also has some things on the birds dying around the world. But the important thing is I want you to pay attention to the geological assessment here in how fast this can occur. Now, these are planetary geologists that are speaking, and hopefully you can hear this as well as it played earlier today. Here we go.
Earth's magnetic field flipped super fast. Just north of a truck stop along Interstate 80 in Battle Mountain, Nevada, lies evidence that the Earth's magnetic field once went haywire. Magnetic minerals and 15-million-year-old rocks appear to preserve a moment when the magnetic North Pole was rapidly on its way to becoming the South Pole, and vice versa. Such geomagnetic field reversals occur every couple hundred thousand years, normally taking about 4,000 years to make the change. The Nevada rock suggests that this particular switch happened at a remarkably fast clip. Anyone carrying a compass would have seen its measurements skewed by about a degree a week, a flash in geologic time. A paper describing the discovery is slated to appear in Geophysical Research Letters. Second super-fast flip of Earth's poles found some 16 million years ago. North became south in a matter of years. Such fast flips are impossible, according to models of the Earth's core. But this is now the second time that evidence has been found. The magnetic poles swap every 300,000 years, a process that normally takes up to 5,000 years. In 1995, an ancient lava flow with an unusual magnetic pattern was discovered in Oregon. It suggested that the field at the time was moving by 6 degrees a day at least 10,000 times faster than usual. Not many people believed it, says Scott Bogue of Occidental College in Los Angeles. Now Bogue and his colleague Jonathan Glenn of the United States Geological Survey in Menlo Park, California, say they have found a second example in Nevada. The lava rock suggests that in 1 year, Earth's magnetic field shifted by 53 degrees. Geophysical Research Letters, doi10.1029 weblink. At that rate, a full flip would take less than 4 years, but there could be another interpretation. It may have been a burst of rapid acceleration that punctuated the steady movement of the field, says Bogue. Peter Olson of Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, Maryland, remains skeptical and points out that the effects could have been local rather than global. Earth is overdue for a reversal, and rapid shifts would cause widespread chaos for navigation in migratory birds, for instance.
So the question that we have to ask is, who is right? On the one hand, we have a flip that takes 4,000 to 5,000 years, hardly anything to be worried about. We have seen societies in our own history that have created edifices and records and buildings and messages for civilizations that would live 1,500 years in the future, hence the Maya leaving the record for us. Now, that is a lot of care, people. You know, we wouldn't leave anything for the legacy of our own grandchildren, let alone someone 1,500 years in the future. I mean, I could tell you, anybody can tell you, governments are writing bad checks as fast as they can make the ink dry. And there's only two reasons why they would do that. Either they never expect to make the checks good, or they're expecting a windfall. And I doubt very seriously that the latter is going to happen. I think they're writing the bad checks with no intention of ever making them good. Our grandchildren will never be able to pay them off because there isn't, literally, isn't enough money in the world to pay it off. That being said, what are they spending the money on? We'll talk a little bit about that in the second hour. It's going to blow your mind, let me tell you. Not what you think at all. So as you can see, the speed of the pole shift in Nevada, born in the geologic record and also in lava flows in Oregon, can be up to 6 degrees a day. What they saw here was a shift of 53 degrees in Earth's magnetism in a period of 4 years. Now, that is free fall in geological time. I know when you're young, 4 years is a long, long time. But once you hit about 50, 4 years is about one summer. Yeah, they speed up time as you get older. I forgot to tell you that. Once they lowered the age of puberty, which, I don't know, it was a little while ago. Because I remember high school girls when I was in high school, and I see high school girls today. Yeah, somebody lowered the age of puberty. I don't know who did it, but it's pretty much national. Anyway, 4 years is not very long. You may remember just a couple of weeks ago we talked about the Tampa airport changing the compass numbers on the runway. That airport's less than 50 years old. When they set up that runway, it was set up on 0 and 1/8. These are the compass settings. They had to change it because the north magnetic pole has shifted so much that the actual compass settings and the numbers that were on the runway don't match. So they had to change it. Now, I have heard someone say recently, I was on another interview on another program, said that, well, airports change their numbers all the time. I don't think so. In fact, I went looking for articles of that. I couldn't find any. Not only that, I've been flying both as a pilot and as a passenger for 4 decades. And I've never seen a runway have its numbers changed. There are runways that are on the same latitude that I have flown in and out of when I was a teenager, taking flying lessons out of Burbank and Fox airports. And those numbers are the same as when I was a kid. They haven't changed. So that assessment is absolutely wrong. The other statement that was made is that the Gulf Stream has stopped. That also is a false report. In fact, the Irish
just got done with a multi-decade buoy study. They have buoys out in the Gulf Stream, and they measure temperature and they measure flow. For many decades, they have been collecting data, and they just recently, I think in the latter part of last year, released a report because they were watching it very closely because of global warming. Believe me, if there was any shift, they would have made a lot of hay by reporting that shift. There was no shift. The Gulf Stream is alive and well, and it's flowing exactly the way it did 40 years ago. No change, no report. So the report that the North Magnetic Pole is moving at the rate of 25 miles a year, not inches as was once thought. We're not wobbling back and forth. I just reread an article that was written a few years ago that the magnetic pole was wobbling 6 inches or 10 inches or 10 feet or whatever a year. Wobbling, moving in a straight line toward Russia. This is a strong indication that the rate of movement is accelerating, and it is following the Coriolis effect formulas closely enough not to be ignored. Now, I'll just briefly tell you what the Coriolis effect is. We'll take a quick break, and then we'll start back on this next hour. The Coriolis effect is a Newtonian theory that has been proven on small and large models many times, and that is a movement of the coordinates in a rotating field. In other words, you have two counter-rotating bodies or two bodies that are rotating at different speeds on the same axis. What will happen is that a line will a force called the Coriolis effect or the Coriolis force will move laterally, literally from the pole to the equator toward the other pole. And it's called the Coriolis effect, and it is a natural force that comes out of the movement of this mass in this fashion. This movement is somewhat linear, isn't a spiral, and what happens is it charts a course directly across the coordinates of your system. In other words, it's like dropping a weight or a plumb bob down from the North Pole. It will go right down alongside your globe. That's the Coriolis effect. The North Magnetic Pole is following that path, just like the center of population of the United States continuously moves west along a linear line somewhere around I-64. So the Coriolis effect makes its way from where it once was, discovered in 1831 by my great-great-grandfather, Sir James Ross, toward Russia. And 25 miles a day, that's across town every single year. In 4 years, it's 100 miles. In case you forgot how small the planet is, it's only a little over 21,000 miles around the fat way. It doesn't take long to travel a lot of distance at 25 miles a year. And when it gets to a certain point, it's sort of like, weebles wobble, but they don't fall down. Once you get to a certain point, it will roll over. It's like a ball that has a heavy side. You can push it, and you can push it, and you can push it until the heavy part gets to the very top, and then you know what's going to happen. It's going to roll over on the other side like a roller coaster, and it's going to swing the planet or swing the gravitational center around like that. So when we come back, now we know how fast it will occur. We know what it is when it occurs. It is this Coriolis movement, this linear movement of the poles in the direction of the other pole. And when we come back, we will talk about the effects of what that will be. Again, I want you to be part of the program. I don't want you to leave you out. It's 530-413-4511 or 530-413-4515. So call in anytime and join us. Let me make sure that we don't have anybody on. click back here. It's hard to toggle between this on this new Skype. Skype used to have separate windows for each Skype conversation that you have open, but now you have one with multiple tabs, so you have to tab between them, and it's not nearly as convenient as the old one because I could simultaneously look at several different conversations at once. If you want to send in a chat, you can do that too just by going in Skype to X2-radio, and then you can send me chat messages in there, and it's free. And it's fast, and you can contribute to the program even if you don't like to hear your voice on the radio. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit about the Horizon Project and what can be expected in the coming, well, I was going to say months, but, you know, maybe just a few years. Anyway, we're already starting to see the evidence. Here we go. Take a quick break. We'll be right back.
Well, I dreamed I saw the knights in armor come, saying something about a queen. There were peasants singing and drummers drumming, and the archers split the tree. There was a fanfare blowing to the sun that was floating on the breeze. Looking Mother Nature on the run in the 21st century. Well, I was lying in a burned up basement with the full moon in my eyes. I was hoping for a replacement when the sun burst through the sky. There was a band playing in my head, and I felt like getting high. I was thinking about what a friend had said. I was hoping it was a lie. Thinking about what a friend had said, I was hoping it was a lie.
Well, I dreamed I saw the silver spaceship flying in the yellow haze of the sun. There were children crying and colors flying all around the chosen one.
All in a dream, all in a dream, the loading had begun. Flying Mother Nature's silver seed to a new home in the sun. Flying Mother Nature's silver seed to a new.
Welcome back to Hour 2 of X Squared Radio. We're glad you're here. We're coming to you live from southern Mississippi. Our IQ window forecast, 44 degrees and clear tonight. By the way, if you were able to run outside right after sunset, you would have seen Jupiter and a crescent moon in a neat conjunction. Mars is straight overhead, that little red thing up there. Pay close attention to that. We have two sunspots, nothing to be excited about, no risk of flares, a small coronal hole with a mild, we could call it a solar breeze occurring right now, not much to get excited about there either. So the sun is pretty much behaving itself nice and quiet, but it's not behaving like we expected it to. We expected by this time to be well into solar cycle 24 with at least M-class flares occurring. So far, nothing like that happening. In our last hour, we talked about the rate at which a pole shift can occur. And we also talked about what would occur with a pole shift, what we can expect to see with respect to the switching of the magnetic field. Now, this hour, what I want to talk about, and of course, this is going to be, you know, far more extensive than we could cover in 2 hours, but I would like to get your phone calls on it. And if you're listening to an archive right now, and you're working on your favorite project there, that's fine too. It doesn't mean that you can't communicate with us. When you listen to this, if you have any questions, go ahead and drop me an email. It's bagnew@x2-radio.com. And you can just go to x2radio.com. All my contact information is there. And write me your question and give me your thoughts about it. By way of advertisement, I want to let you know that I am open to come to speak to your book clubs, your organizations, your events, any radio interviews that you need expert guests on. I am open anytime, anywhere. I do not charge to come and speak. My rates are on the website. If you go to click the link, have me speak at your event, you can see what you should charge for those events. The only thing that I ask is my travel expenses be paid and a way for me to sell books and films and things like that, which I'm sure you would want me to do anyway. But the goal is to get the word out. I don't do this as a living. It is a hobby. It is a great interest of mine. I don't do it to make a killing. If I make a little bit of money, I just put my kids through college with it. So it's not, believe me, I don't live on this. I am a full-time employed engineer. I am building my own company to manufacture electric cars. Those of you that follow my work know this. That's my form of income. So this I do out of the love of my heart. So if you can help out in any way by providing those whom you know that may not have heard this message, may not have heard or read Remembering the Future, the Physics of the Soul and Time Travel. They may not know about the North Pole Inner Earth Expedition. They may not know about the archaeological and scientific origin and destiny of the Earth. These are subjects upon which I speak, and I would be happy to come to your place, wherever it is, any corner of the Earth. And I will even, if it's possible, learn your language and give as much of the presentation in your language as I can. Be happy to do it. Please contact me. There's plenty of the year left. There's going to be plenty of opportunities for conferences and even salons. You don't have to put a full conference together. Put together 10, 12, 15 people and buy a cheap plane ticket, and I'll come there and speak to your small group. It's no problem. Happy to do it. It's the mainstream of how we get this information out there. Put that on the thought wagon for your planning for the year. If you're putting together something at your university, you're putting together something for your civic organization or your church. Love to speak at churches. Have no problem doing that. This message is quite spiritual and certainly non-denominational, but can fit into just about any scriptural approach. Trust me, I taught Sunday school for 30 years, so I know exactly how to behave under those conditions. Sorry, missed the cough button there. All right, in this hour, we're going to talk about what the effects of a pole shift are going to be. So let me get a drink of water, clear my throat. 40 seconds. We will be right back. Don't go away. X Squared Radio about to take off.
Spice extends life. The spice expands consciousness. The spice is vital to space travel.
My good friend Brent Miller, who is the producer of remote viewing CDs, training DVDs, and you could buy those by going to xsquaredradio.com, clicking on the icon there. Learn to remote view from the creators and of intuitive design. And also, if you've heard of Ed Dames, this is the same method that was developed. And we also have a good friend, Skip Atwater, that that teaches this as well. And he does a really good job down there. I'm trying to remember the name of his, the Monroe Institute. That's what it is, Skip Atwater at the Monroe Institute. Either one of those. But my good friend Brent Miller produced a video some years ago called The Kill Shot. And this was actually quite successful. It was so well produced and it was so informative to people that they followed it up with the next in the series called The Horizon Project. Now, you've heard it advertised for years on this program. We strongly recommend that you get a chance to view this documentary. It's important that you see it. It might be one of the most important documentaries that you see. We're excited about it still after all these years. And I can tell you, we just don't give up on this message because it's important. This is a clip from that production of the Horizon Project. It's a little slick, but it's actually quite well done. And if you don't have a copy of it, we're going to play, maybe 8 or 9 minutes of it. If you don't have a copy of it, you can get it by going to X Squared Radio, clicking on the banner for the Horizon Project. You get 5% off, I think, buying it this way. They'll ship it to you right away. It is a super, super well done documentary. It's like Discovery Channel on steroids. His son is the cameraman and production artist, and he really does a fantastic job. All right, here we go. We'll play a little bit of this. It's about a 7-minute clip. I don't know if I'll play the whole thing, but here we go. Okay?
Galaxies require a massive compact energy source of enormous strength to stabilize the orbits of stars contained within them. The engine, which drives the direction of rotation and shape of each galaxy, consists of what astrophysicists refer to as a supermassive black hole located in the direct center. The central black hole located within our galaxy contains an estimated mass of over 1 trillion stars and is believed to be over 2 trillion miles in diameter. Many leading astro and quantum physicists also believe that supermassive black holes spin at an unbelievably high rate due to their overwhelming mass. At this high rate of spin, the black hole's projected gravitational field is no longer spherical, but rather flattens out to form a massive yet extremely thin spinning disk. Our galactic plane can easily be identified by even the untrained eye. As one views the shape and characteristics of our own galaxy from images provided by the Hubble telescope and projected computer simulations, we can easily see that all matter moves and is formed around this flattened gravitational influence.
This also explains why all galaxies are flat and circular. If you look at our own galaxy, there exists a dark band which shows you where this gravitational plane is located, where galactic dust and mass has been collecting since the birth of the galaxy. This is where we can easily see the location of the galactic plane, which is what modern science refers to as the galactic equinox.
But what does this have to do with humanity's future? In the Milky Way, which is an active galaxy, our solar system cyclically moves above and below this galactic plane. As stars and planetary systems, including our own, approach this galactic plane, the gravitational influence increases, which disturbs the stability of each planet, including Earth. The passage through the densest portion of the gravitational plane is the direct cause of the devastating cycles and pole shifts that we see recorded throughout Earth's history. This cyclic nature of our solar system as we move through the Milky Way is precisely how many ancient civilizations based their calendar systems. The Mayans themselves describe what they refer to as the Dark Rift, or the galactic plane, in ways eerily similar to those of modern scientists and physicists. The Mayans state that the end of each age, which brings about worldwide devastation, is defined by the world sitting on the Dark Rift. Even though the Mayans don't clearly present the science behind why the galactic plane causes severe implications upon Earth's stability in modern terminology, it is very clear that we are talking about the same event, an event where the Earth passes through the galactic equinox, the Dark Rift, or the central plane. It all refers to the cyclic and destructive gravitational influence created by the supermassive black hole at the center of the Milky Way. Researchers and scientists agree that we are indeed approaching the end of what the Mayans define as the current age. Even though many science groups are still debating the full implications of what passing through the galactic plane will have upon Earth, we have already begun to see the early stages that the increased gravitational influence is having upon our world and other planets in the solar system. As we approach the gravitational plane, we will continue to experience severe weather and ecological effects such as earthquakes, tsunamis, hurricanes, and volcanic activity with increased frequency and intensity. As we penetrate the densest portion of the galactic plane and experience the full gravitational effects, we may witness unprecedented solar flares, unexpected meteor showers, and one or more geographical pole shifts. Subsequently, unexpected celestial objects may pass through the solar system, as they too are influenced by the gravitational plane. This may account for the ancient records describing several past worldwide catastrophes accompanied by passing bodies, comets, or what some researchers today refer to as Planet X.
Utilizing the latest in research data, we can speculate that due to the overwhelming rate of spin and the generated gravitational field, the galactic plane or gravitational disk could relatively be paper thin, requiring Earth, with our current speed of movement through the galaxy, only a few years to completely pass through this plane, experiencing the full effect upon Earth's stability. If this data is correct, could this be what the Bible refers to as the 7 years of tribulation, in which the Earth undergoes a series of devastating global catastrophes which result in the death of billions?
Well, one thing is for sure. The ancients endured several worldwide catastrophes that all but erased their civilizations from the face of the earth. Their clues, structural remains, and records have attempted to warn us and prepare us for the reoccurrence of this cyclic event. Warnings that so far humanity has ignored. Though modern researchers have a general time frame, we are still unable to pinpoint the exact year in which we will begin passing through the galactic plane. So even though the telltale signs are already evident throughout our world, how can it be known for sure when you should be bracing for tomorrow?
Computer simulations utilizing the collection of knowledge we have amassed through decades of galactic models and satellite data tells us that our solar system will definitely begin passing through the galactic plane in the very near future. The most severe effects that will cause worldwide devastation and a pole shift are most likely to occur beginning sometime between the years 2008 and 2015.
So that is the clip from the Horizon Project. Now, it is about a 90-minute documentary, and it is so well produced. The video quality is really high definition. And the music is great, and the content is absolutely flawless. So I highly recommend that you pick that up and view it for yourself. Now, we were talking a little bit about the effects, about the actual symptoms that we would see once we got close to this, that we would see not just ordinarily bad weather, but extremely bad weather. And I didn't want to go back too far in history. But I wanted to make sure that as part of this audio record, if you're sitting down reading, you can perhaps Google this yourself and find out some of this information for yourself. But I condensed it all here so that you've got it locally. Queensland is down in near Sydney, in Australia, And the floods that have occurred this year, now last year they were really devastating, but the floods that have inundated 22 Australian towns and forced more than 200,000 from their homes headed toward the northeast coast on New Year's Day, forcing further evacuations and warnings of 30-foot floodwaters. Australia has endured its wettest spring on record ever, causing six river systems in tropical Queensland to flood, as soaring temperatures in the states of Victoria and South Australia sparked warnings of devastating bushfires. The rain has flooded coal mines and hit farming hard, with many roads still impassable, and prompted warnings of the dangers of crocodiles and snakes in flooded homes. The inland sea that stretches, let's see, hang on, I paged down a little bit and lost my place. Oh, the inland sea that stretches across Queensland is dotted with the roofs of flooded homes, islands of dry ground, crowded and stranded livestock and small boats ferrying people in emergency supplies. That was 3 weeks ago, and they're still not crawling out from underneath that yet. Now, I just want to take you back 6 months during the Australian winter when it snowed in Sydney. It snowed in Sydney. Yes. Record cold. So if you take the extremes in the summer and the extremes in the winter, you might not have too much of a mean, that is to say, an average temperature shift. But either end of the extremes, the min and max are very high. At the same time that this is going on in Australia, 10 ships, 600 crew trapped in the frozen sea of Okhotsk. Rescue efforts are underway to evacuate more than 600 crew on 10 ships trapped in ice in the Sea of Okhotsk. That's Okhotsk, okay? The ice is up to 12 inches thick in some places, according to the Russian news agency. And these are not icebreakers. These are just normal shipping vessels, that freight vessels that are getting caught in the ice. And these are also fishing boats. They're used to these seas, okay? Signals are reported to have been received from a fishing boat and a research vessel, which are in the greatest distress, stuck in the ice about 12 miles from the coast. Believe me, my great-great-grandfather, very familiar with this, stuck in the ice for 2 years, barely escaped with his life, and did lose some crew. The Sea Rescue Center says the three tugboats have been dispatched. One of the tugboats is expected to reach the edge of the ice on Friday, which was day before yesterday, and the others will be there by today. The temperature in the area is minus 22 degrees C. For those of you that can't make metric conversions in your mind, that is well below zero, okay? Minus 40 degrees C is also minus 40 degrees F. So we're way down there, pretty close to 0 degrees F. Now, we will come a little bit further to our side, and this is the strangest effects now that we're beginning to see weather anomalies, which, boy, this week we've had our share too. 2 degrees in Dallas, in Nacogdoches, and the cold stretched even further south. We've got another article down here to cover that. Actually, cold weather shut down states in Mexico. Yeah, in Mexico. Record low temperatures hit the city across from El Paso, Texas, from Tuesday, which is already suffering from some of the worst violence in Mexico's drug war, fluctuating between minus 0.4 and 10 degrees Fahrenheit. Units at 17 power stations with 6,792 megawatts of generating capacity in northern Mexico shut down due to the unusually cold weather, forcing the national electricity monopoly to ask factories to curb usage. Also in the news, New Mexico in the United States declared a state of emergency because they ran out of natural gas capacity. Yeah, natural gas capacity. No, they're not running out of natural gas. It's just that the record cold is requiring people to heat their homes with an unprecedented amount of energy. And that energy is more than the gas system can deliver. And so New Mexico asked for help from Mexico and were turned down. So they have a state of emergency in the state of New Mexico. Normally it does get quite cold in New Mexico, but evidently it's colder longer than what they normally see. Now the strange thing is that in recent weeks, we have also seen strange effects in the animal kingdom. This goes back to, let me see if I can get the date on this article. This was February 3rd, which is just a few days ago. It says, Friday night, ringing in the new year on a whole different meaning, took on a whole different meaning for the citizens of Beebe around 11:30 p.m. This is back in the very beginning of January. Enforcement officers with Arkansas Game and Fish Commission began getting reports of dead blackbirds falling from the sky in the city limits of Beebe. Now, this started in Arkansas, went to Texas, went to Tennessee, Italy, birds dropping out of the sky, and not just blackbirds, ducks and doves, and birds that normally are migratory birds, but also birds that fly in flocks, not singular birds flying around up there, but they fly in tight pairs or tight groups. Those of you that have driven out of the country have seen blackbirds kind of moving in the sky by the hundreds of thousands, like schools of fish. They estimated that over 1,000 birds had fallen out of the sky over the city before midnight. Most of the birds were dead, but some were still alive when officers arrived. The blackbirds fell over a one-mile area in the city. Now, this wasn't statewide. This was local, which really made the Centers for Disease Control quite nervous. Of course, they picked some up and took them to the Arkansas Livestock and Poultry Commission, LAB, and the National Wildlife Health Center lab in Madison, Wisconsin. No report. They reported that the birds had suffered some trauma, which you will do when you hit the ground at 70 miles an hour. But one of the common things that they noticed is that the birds appeared to have perished from altitude sickness. They stopped breathing in mid-flight. Something about the way they breathe, they simultaneously, as a group, just didn't breathe enough and suffocated mid-flight and dove into the ground unconscious. Now, some had told me that, well, maybe it was HARP. So we did some phone calls. We checked around. Guess what? No HARP signature. A HARP signature, the HARP, by the way, is the High Frequency Active Auroral Research Project, HAARP. You can look it up in Google if you like to. We did a documentary on it in 1997, did another one for the History Channel 2 years ago, and one for True TV a year ago. So we are very well versed on HARP. I am one of the consulting scientists on the civilian side, calling for some civilian oversight of this system, which appears to be at least an effective weapon system, and most likely a very effective high-power directional communication system. What it's used to communicate is also part of the controversy. To submarines with ELF coded messages, most certainly, but also able to broadcast in the band that has particular effects on the neuropathology of human physiology. In other words, it can make you have anxiety, bad dreams, sleeplessness, nervousness, bowel movements, schizophrenia, voices in your head, that kind of thing. And they can be used in the battlefield quite effectively, and have been in the battlefield. We have mobile equipment that does what HARP does on a very directional basis. But HARP, of course, has billions of watts behind it and acts as an ionospheric heater. And it isn't the only one in the world. We have a couple of them, and the Russians have one, and the Chinese have one, and all of that energy being pumped into the ionosphere without any regard for the long-term effects. Some are purporting that the effects actually could be beneficial, healing the ozone layer, creating high-altitude cloud cover, which can reverse global warming. But the side effects are perhaps more devastating and more risky than what they can imagine. We can imagine it because we're out here as experts in the field, and I've used it in the field probably still longer than anyone on the planet. So I understand what they're doing on a very local level because I helped develop it into a oil and gas exploration system. Going along with this very strange effect on zoology, on livestock, on birds, on crabs, on fish, is the idea that there might be this disturbance in Earth's magnetic field. Now, with the North Magnetic Pole moving toward Russia at the rate of 25 miles a year, it isn't all stability. If you go to the USGS's own website, you will see computer models for what a pole shift would look like. Now, the current geological planet core geology idea is that we have a planet filled with molten metal and molten rock, and that the movement of this underneath the crust is what generates the magnetic fields, that it's a very complex, almost unpredictable magnetic makeup. That being said, we end up with the end effect of having a planet that acts like it has a bar magnet right down the middle of it, with the North Pole at the top, what we consider the top, and the South Pole at the bottom. And the flux going out into space, curving around the planet like a giant wireframe and going back into the bottom of the planet. These flux lines are continuous. They're unbroken. That's electromagnetic theory. Einstein got his PhD in that field. So there are certain postulates in that theory that say that the flux lines are unbroken, and so they are. But the appearance of that magnetic field is indicative of a core that is somewhat in chaos. And that being said, it's fairly predictable where, at least in a certain way, where that magnetic field is going to lie. Now, when it becomes unstable, when this Coriolis effect begins to drag it off center and it begins to not revolve around the same axis that the actual physical planet is rotating, then you end up with this amoebic kind of roiling magnetic field. And that they show with colors on their website. And the model is quite stunning. I wish I could show it on the radio. That would be a feat, wouldn't it? But basically, it looks like a dye being stirred into, chocolate being stirred into milk or into a vanilla cake. What you see is this nice line of demarcation, generally right where the equator is, when everything's all stable and hunky-dory. And then you begin to see at the equator sort of fingers and rivulets forming ripples, sort of like the Simpsons' mouth when they burp. You ever watch that? It's kind of funny. Very clever program. Anyway, over time, as it gets worse and worse and the undulations in the field become more and more extreme, it begins to turn over. And what happens is, relatively suddenly, geologically speaking, the entire thing turns over and north becomes south and south becomes north. Now, let's talk about the effects of while it's happening. While it's happening, animals and biosystems that rely heavily upon stable magnetic alignments can't function. They can't think, they can't migrate, they can't negotiate their normal everyday life cycles. And so things that they rely upon, like water, like bugs, like seeds and things that are part of their, shall we call it, Darwinian development through natural selection, that have allowed them to survive as a species, are now moving out of the way. They're now not where they left them. And so even if they did manage to make it back to the same nesting grounds, even if they did manage to get back to the same feeding grounds, it is quite possible that what they live off of, the bugs, the seeds, the flowers, the bacteria, whatever, are not there. They will arrive at the same old neighborhood and it will be sterile of what it is that keeps them alive. Animals are very suited to the food that they consume. A perfect example would be the koala. The koala lives on eucalyptus leaves, but not just any eucalyptus leaves. Their genetics, from bear to bear, from literally pod to pod, are specific to a certain genetics of eucalyptus trees. You can't just pull a koala from one place in Australia, take it to someplace else, and toss it up in an eucalyptus tree and expect it to survive. It will eat the leaves and nothing will happen. It will be as though that animal is eating sterilized, non-nutritive cellulose. No nutrition, the bear dies. And that's exactly what would happen. What would happen is species that don't survive very well now in the ecology that we have will flourish. And species that now flourish won't survive very well at all. So the ecology will shift. We will perhaps see geese replaced with another species of bird. We will see mackerel replaced with another fish, because the flora of the area upon which the fauna survive is going to shift as well. This is the function of the magnetic field of the Earth. It could have resonance effects with everything from the replication of protein, which for those of you that aren't molecular biologists, and I'm not, but I read it and understand it and have family in it, the folding and unfolding of proteins is at least repeatable. We don't really understand why it happens or what the mechanism of how it happens, but we do understand the result of it, that the protein becomes duplicated by and large perfectly every single time with, you know, a normal distribution of errors. Some of those errors do not provide any survivability increase or improvement to that species, and so the species very quickly dies. But sometimes that mutation, as it were, can be a survivability advantage and allow a species to survive very well in one ecology where it wouldn't survive very well in another. Case in point would be white moths surviving in a beech forest, whereas black moths would survive very well in an oak forest. Obviously, they wouldn't survive if they were mixed up, because the black moths would show up very well on white trees and be eaten very quickly by birds and not survive. And vice versa, the white ones would show up and the blue jays would make short work of them. So this selection of genes is in symbiosis with the environment around them. That environment changes just a little bit, just different plants grow or different bacteria grows, because the magnetic field gets involved in this protein replication process, and the ecology is adding the effects upon that environment, making the genes choose a different way, then everything that lives on that is going to change. It would be sort of like chocolate becoming distasteful anymore. I mean, that would be the end of the world, right? It would be. Come on. By the way, there's going to be a chocolate shortage in 2014. Yes, the demand for chocolate is far outweighing the supply. We had a caller, but we're having technical difficulties. So we've reset the phones, and we want the caller to call back. So try that phone call again. Sorry about that. By the way, let me go ahead and give those numbers out again, because as we get further into this, I want to talk more and more about these effects. I want to see what's happening in your neck of the woods. The number is 530-413-4511, 530-413-4511, or 4515. So either one of those numbers, if we can't get through, just keep trying. We just became aware that we were having a phone problem, and we've got it fixed now. So call in. Be happy to talk about any subject you want to talk about. But if you can stay on task, that would be great. So we're having weather anomalies. We're having magnetic anomalies. And we've talked about, from time to time, these rogue waves that occur. A rogue wave is like a tsunami, except that it is moving through the ocean at subsonic speeds, 300 or 400 miles an hour, and it's in deep water. So you get maybe a swell, but the wave doesn't rise up and crash because the seafloor is deep. But what we are hearing from maritime reports, and these are super tankers, these are cruise ships, these are freighters, is that these rogue waves are now occurring at the rate of about one a month. And I even heard a rate recently of one every 3 weeks. Now, of course, the rate of these is increasing. I'm sure that shipping traffic hasn't really increased that much. We have the same number of ships going back and forth between countries that we've had probably for 30 years, maybe longer. But the size of those ships is changing. Some of these ships are several hundred feet long. Some of the oil tankers are even thousands of feet long. And this, just because it takes one engine or a group of engines to get them moving, and then once they're moving, it's pretty stable, and the rate is pretty cheap for shipping. But if you've ever seen these ships at sea, they're basically crane ships. They have cranes at either end and, of course, hold. But they'll have shipping containers like a semi bed out of steel. The shipping container itself is quite heavy, and then it will be loaded with stuff, and they're usually 10 by 10 by 20 or 8 by 10 by 20, 8 feet wide, 10 feet high, and 20 feet or 40 feet long, or sometimes 53 feet long, so they'll fit right on a tractor trailer rig. And then they're stacked 10 to 15 layers high. So, you know, a lot of these cube out before they wade out, but still, that's a lot stacked on there. And they're just stacked, people. They're not, you know, lashed down, because these things aren't going to be affected by the wind. So when these ships hit these rogue waves, guess what happens? Yeah, the shipping containers get spilled over. They go right over the side and right to the bottom. And I can tell you, there are tens of thousands of these shipping containers with everything from, you know, Nike tennis shoes to car parts dumped over the side of these ships. So it is somewhat less risky now to ship across the oceans than it was during colonial times. But you remember the old adage, you know, his ship came in. In other words, he's made it big. He's made the big time. He's made it rich. Because the odds of actually getting a successful shipment from, say, the colonies back to Europe, or the finished goods that those raw materials purchased or traded for in Europe making its way back to the U.S., were pretty slim. Those odds were pretty slim. So when your ship came in, one shipment was enough to make a man a millionaire in those days. So it's we rely on it pretty heavily now, especially in the automotive industry. When we order transmissions or we order seats or instruments or chassis parts, they're loaded in as high a density as we can stand. In other words, packed in what we call dunnage, which is sort of reusable racks that can be returned and filled up again and again and again. Those are shipped to the U.S. Those parts are then taken out, assembled, the dunnage is put in back in the shipping containers and shipped back. That daisy chain of movement has become pretty reliable. Logistics has become a computer science, sort of like faxing your freight. But when these rogue waves get mixed into the formula, it makes things somewhat unpredictable. So you have to have contingency plans for that. And that's why the study of these rogue waves has become so perfected, because it is driven by economics. In the automotive business, we're driven by a standard called TS-16949, 16949. It is the graduate of ISO 9000 or ISO, what's called QS 9000. One is for electronics and light bulbs and clothing and hospital stuff, and QS 9000's pretty much geared toward the automotive industry because we've refined it to an absolute science. And then even though those are wonderful standards, they more or less drive you to document everything, which doesn't necessarily mean that you make a good product. You just document it well. But the TS standard drives you to a systemic, a process way of thinking that does drive you to make a better product. It does drive you to use your customers' attributes as controls for your processes, and it makes you a better company. There's no doubt about it. The registration process is still lethargic and expensive and troublesome, but the process thinking is certainly a good way to go. Anyway, that standard drives us to develop backup plans, contingency plans for everything, literally. I mean, if the Russians attacked on the coast of Florida wearing rubber gum boots, it's already been figured out. A team of experts has already examined it, already has a contingency plan in place. I'm being facetious, but we have backup plans to backup plans so that we don't have a spill. No, I don't mean like spill your milk or spill oil on the floor or have a toxic spill. That's not what I mean. A spill in manufacturing means some part didn't show up on time, and so production has to stop. That's called a spill. Yeah, if enough piston rings don't show up, yeah, engine line stops. No motors, no cars, that's a spill. We try to make sure no supplier, whether they're supplying number 10 screws or whether they're supplying six-way adjustable seats, no supplier spills the line. Backup plans to backup plans to backup plans. And the higher the risk, and believe me, shipping by sea and shipping by rail, both very high risks. Backup plans to backup plans. That's why these rogue waves are being studied so carefully, because they're expensive when they happen. Well, the interesting thing about these waves is they are increasing in frequency, and they are very, very powerful. You're talking about a mountain of water moving at subsonic speeds, but literally hundreds and hundreds of feet per second, 300 to 400 miles an hour these things travel. Now, that being said, they are traveling parallel to the coasts in deep water, 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 meter deep water. So you get a swell in the water, and that certainly perturbs the ship and spills the coffee. But if these waves begin turning, which they would do during a pole shift, because the magnetic poles definitely have an effect on the tides and the way we interact with the moon, because the moon is in very close orbit around the Earth, and the moon tidally applies its gravity to Earth, stretching it and squeezing it and causing our oceans to move around like clockwork. You don't believe me? Pick up an almanac. I can tell you when high tide is going to be on the third Wednesday of July in the year 2015. It is like clockwork. But that clock is going to change when the pole shift begins to occur. And when that occurs, these rogue waves are going to turn. They're going to change course. And instead of going parallel to the shorelines, they're going to turn perpendicular to the shorelines. Now, this makes a big difference because now you have a wave of energy that's moving through the water like you whipped a loop in a rope, and it's going down to the end of the rope, and it's going to get to the end, and it's going to whip that can and or snap the whip like a bullwhip. What you're doing now is you're turning that force toward the shore, and now you're pushing that wave into a disappearing depth. In other words, the seafloor is coming up fast, and that energy has to go somewhere. And where does it go? It goes up, and it creates a wave. Now, there was a surfing contest last week in Southern California. The surfers were kind of languishing because the waves were kind of puny. It happens, you know. You got all the cameras set up, and everybody knows when high tide's going to be, and everybody gets out there, and the weather's maybe it's a little cool, you know. We're in the little shorty wetsuits, but generally we're ready for it, and we're out there sitting on the board and paddling around, and all of a sudden, guess what? 40-foot wave shows up. Yeah, unexpected wave. So the surfers panicked, tried to paddle into it to get past it before it crested and crashed, but it still crashed on several surfers, almost killing several, sending a couple to the hospital. Surprise, right in the middle of minding your own business, sitting on your board. All right, let's go ahead and take that call from Arkansas. You're on line three. Welcome to the program, Steve.
Not Arkansas, Dr. Agnew, Alaska.
Oh, AK. AK, that's Alaska.
That's Alaska. How are you, sir? Okay.
Hey, I'm doing pretty well. Actually, the weather turned a little bit today. We had like 5 days of miserable cold rain as we fed down here from the Gulf of Mexico, fed that storm that blanketed three quarters of the country with record-breaking snow.
Well, it's just been balmy up here. I'm sure you know that.
Yeah, I reckon so.
Right. Yeah, right now it's about 23, 24 degrees, which is a little warm for us this time of year. I was in Fairbanks not long ago when it was 45 below, and the next week it was 45 above. You might recall
wow.
that.
It wow,
was
that's
just unbelievable.
Shift. 100 degree shift in 1 week. Wow.
That happened. That happened. And, in fact, I was just on the computer today looking at the weather, and they were talking about it. It was interesting. Right now, the Knit River, which right now is, you could put a semi down the middle of it. It's usually totally frozen this time of year. I thought it was really interesting. I came out of Anchorage to see my son in Wasilla driving by and looking at that, and I thought, now, this is just not right. You know, 3 years ago, we had 43 days of sub-zero weather. Someone was matching 40 below here in Anchorage, the high winds, you know, which is not too much unusual for us. But last year, really warm. This year, very warm.
Well, what does that do for the insect population? I mean, I heard that the mosquitoes are like light aircraft up there. They only are alive for a few weeks, and so they got to go out and get as much blood as they can get, which they do. You can hear them diving. What does that do to the insect population? Do they just explode when it gets warm like that?
They just explode. They just explode. And we were sitting around the sauna down at the men's club just the other night talking about that. If this continues, what it can do for us this year. And it's, you know, what can I say? I read your book, Remembering. That's quite a book.
Well, I appreciate it. What were your thoughts?
I just thought it was absolutely amazing. I know it's true. You know, I've been able to get to some of these places spiritually through meditation. And, what can you say, Dr. Brooks or Dr. Agnew, to someone that's not awake, you know, at all? You know, what can you say to those people? Because you want to reach out and touch them. You want to tell them, you know, we can change this with intent. We can do this. You know, if we just all work together a little bit. But, you know, people aren't awake, and I don't know what's going to wake people up outside of maybe going to the inner earth and finding a civilization there with a lot more sense than we got in terms of who we are.
Well, you know, I thought about that. You know what? You know, with the synergy of how everything that's come into my life seems to work, I think about that North Pole Inner Earth expedition and all the science behind it, all the questions that could be answered by an expedition like that. But that being said, when I tour the country and I speak on this subject, and I do approach it from a very mainstream point of view, the people that come up and talk to me about it are really deeply moved about this. They really feel as though if we could connect somehow, irrefutably connect with some other race that lives here on this planet, where we could see it right on the screen, not, you know, computer generated, but real. I think it would wake people up. It would make people realize that we are not alone. And you really do take a different approach to who we are as human beings. You know, are we Scottish? Are we Jewish? Are we black? Are we, you know, Japanese? Or are we earthlings? Answering that question would be profound.
Oh, Lord. I try to talk to some folks, you know, and I take a spectrum. There's a guy in our group there at the sauna, you know, he's a hit. You know, he knows a lot about everything. And I've kind of touched on a few things with him, and he doesn't want to look beyond what Fox News tells him. And you think, how can you be educated? How can anyone watch television news and think that any of it's true?
Well, you know, that being said, Fox News, almost not on a daily basis, but surely on a weekly basis, they run some kind of really amazing footage. They talk about UFOs. They talk about pole shifts. They had Michio Kaku the other day talking about a solar tsunami. These are wake-up calls. These are really serious wake-up calls, and you're not going to hear about it on CNN, that's for sure.
I agree with that. I just wish that people, and I pray to my higher self constantly, that just somehow, some way, something can happen in enough time to keep this from happening to us. To keep it from happening for the people that are in the future.
Yeah, that's right.
We can stop it. You know, we've just got to get out of all these fear-based economies. You know, we've got to get out of this stuff. Well, now, if you just invest with me, everything's going to be fine, you know? I mean, like, I'm paying him. I'm paying this man, and he's telling me it's going to be fine. Well, I suppose he would say that.
Yeah, like David Morrison getting on and saying,
you know, none of this is going to be fine, you know? None of this is going to be fine if we don't get into consciousness, if we don't move forward with positive intention, if we don't move. I mean, we could do so many things, you know. We could stop fighting a lot of the folks in Africa and just start helping make water systems. There's a multitude of positive things we could do for humanity.
I could tell you, I you know, we were in Egypt just a few weeks ago, and I had been there before. But this time, the tenor of the tourist-Egypt relationship was a little tense. There was a big rift between the haves and the have-nots. And one of the things that I noticed, if you get right out of the immediate area around the pyramids, and you really don't have to drive far, 1 mile, maybe two, is that the canals that feed off of the Nile are absolutely choked with trash. Bottles and paper and tires and motors, and this is where people get their drinking water. This is where they get their drinking water. Now, if you can't provide your people the basics like water, you're going to have trouble. And sure enough, a few weeks later, the people said enough is enough.
It's the same thing as when you look at these carriers, talking about China making a carrier. Well, that's just what China needs. We just need more super carriers out there. We just simply don't have enough. But, you know, we could take one carrier group that we presently have with the equipment we have on that carrier group. We could go into some of these third world countries. And we're not talking specifically about the United States right now. We're quickly getting there. But the point is we could go there and for humanity make that ship work for humanity, not to kill humanity.
Yeah, good. We could. We could spend $1.3 trillion on getting people decent drinking water. Well, I've got my phones are stacked up, Steve. I really appreciate the call. Thanks for the update. Please call back anytime. And thanks for reading the book, too. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you, Doctor. Thank you so much. Have a good evening.
You too. Good night. Let's go ahead and get Dan from Michigan on. Dan, welcome to the program.
Are you talking about Diane?
Oh, yeah. Diane. Yeah.
Hi, hey, hi Brooks. This is Diane from Michigan, KPAC.
Sweetheart, how are you?
I'm great. Haven't talked to you for a while.
Oh, my goodness.
Just want to let you know I escaped from Cairo.
Yeah. How was that? I'd like to have a firsthand ground report.
Well, I'd like to tell you that most everything you've heard is propaganda.
Well, that's what I thought. You know, I have friends over there, and they said, look, this started out as kind of a Twitter thing. They were going to come across the bridge, you know, march of solidarity. Hey, we want some freedom. Largely hijacked by a bunch of troublemakers, and I think it's generally peaceful. Everything I see on camera, I think the audio is kind of blown out of proportion. But I don't really know what's going on over there. You do. Tell us about it.
Well, I got back into the States on Friday. I was supposed to fly out on Sunday. Most of it was government propaganda. They shut down the internet. They shut down the cell phones. Had a wonderful trip up till the point of the past Thursday, actually, when they really start cracking down and everything. But the people there are absolutely wonderful. I mean, what they're doing is what the people of the United States should be doing, and maybe I'm presumptuous in saying that, but everything, you know, the government let out the prisoners from all the prisons, according to the local news.
Right.
The local news said that they let the prisoners out, and those were actually the what was causing the problem. It wasn't the people that were the protesters there. They were very nonviolent.
Yeah,
I had gone downtown Cairo, and I don't. You've been there. I mean, Cairo is a city of 20 million people. And what I was most astounded at is the fact that there's not a stop sign or a traffic signal anywhere in Cairo with 20 million people, and I never saw an accident. And astoundingly.
Yeah, I haven't either, not between buses or even camels. I mean, I've seen camels in downtown Cairo.
Mules, carts, tricycles, motorcycles, buses, cars, and there's not a traffic signal or a stop sign anywhere within a city of 20 million people.
It's true. Now, I've been in cabs where they've gotten so close, you know, the cab driver's kind of reached out and pushed the other truck away with his hand.
Oh, but, can't walk between cars. There's not enough room for a body to walk between cars.
That's right. But they thread them in there, and it's pretty amazing. So generally what you're telling me is that the people, the actual protesters that are out there saying, look, we're tired of whatever rule that we have here, and we need some basics here, okay? Things that government should supply, you know, general welfare like water. I know when we drove in the old part of Cairo, there's an ancient cemetery that's there, thousands of years old, and it's full of mausoleums, and it's several city blocks. There are people living. They're living in there because there's no accommodations for the people. There are no apartments. There's no building going on. There's no basic infrastructure to support the people.
Well, contrary to that comment, there is much infrastructure going on there. I found out that when you look at the buildings and you being there, I asked the question to one of the locals there of why there were so many incredible new structures or even old structures that looked like they were under construction that didn't have any windows or they were, you know, they had blankets over openings and so forth, because they're taxed. They're taxed on anything, and so what happens is as long as they don't have glass in the structures, they're not taxed because it's still under construction. Once they put glass in the windows, they are then taxed heavily. And so the fathers build structures for their children, daughter, son, and they put the windows in their main dwellings, but they don't put the windows or glass in the subsequent higher levels or lower levels. And so through all of Egypt, I mean, not just Cairo, but all of Egypt, this goes on, so they're not taxed.
You see a lot
and
of buildings
that
are
revolting against.
Yeah, right, exactly. That kind of government is what they're revolting against. And it's been, you know, basically a fixed election for 30 years.
Oh, absolutely.
And the people are tired of that. Now, I suspect that the violence that we're seeing, and of course the news cameras, what has been able to get out that we have seen here in this country, you know, a few Molotov cocktails, a few burning cars, you know, breaking glass, stuff like that. This is not the protesters doing this.
No. No, actually, what I saw, and I went right downtown Cairo. I went right through the whole thing on a taxi because I couldn't get out. I was supposed to get out last Sunday, a week ago today. And I was, I got down. There was 50, I mean, I don't know how many people were at the airport, but it was astronomical, and no one knew. And the poor people at the airport were so overwhelmed. I mean, I can't believe the airlines were not cooperative. It was just deplorable of what took place at the airport. And many of the people were running because they didn't know what to expect because it was the propaganda that was put out by the media. And so I took a taxi back to the hotel, which was at Giza, which is an hour away. And it was just mayhem. It was mayhem because they created it. It wasn't because of the people. And going down, I had a taxi driver. This is unbelievable, Brooks. This taxi driver, he was so proud of the burning of the police stations and the police cars and the police vans. He was pointing them all out to me, and I said, all I want to do is get back to my hotel because he was so excited about the fact of what they had achieved, that they were bringing down the government. And well, I was really, it was like a Ron Paul, I shouldn't say that. I should say that it was like they wanted to bring some civility. They wanted to bring, you know, some peace and democracy to this. But
well,
it was nothing. There was no violence. I saw no violence whatsoever.
That I'm glad to hear. I really am. You had said something a few minutes ago that the Egyptians are doing something that we Americans should be doing. I one thing that I've noticed in the last few months, well, actually it began some years ago, but in the last few months it's really gotten some momentum. 27 states in the United States have filed or have passed sovereignty acts. Tennessee, Texas.
Yes.
New Hampshire, Vermont. I mean, these are states that are, you know, generally conservative, but these sovereignty acts are allowing a process which we have not seen since before the Civil War called nullification. This is where states can basically choose not to follow federal mandates unless they are ratified by the state government. Now, that's what caused Lincoln to lose control of the government when he became president. He was
Absolutely
such a
right.
poor leader. He was such a terrible president that he could not keep the nation together. He let the Senate and the Congress rip the country apart by taxing the South into poverty to the benefit of the North. And that's what caused the war. Well, now...
Right.
We have this situation, the same situation arising.
You know what? I am so that my heart sings for what you just said. Because you know that no one knows that reality about Lincoln. Very few know that reality. Thank you, Brooks, for mentioning that. That is such an incredible statement that you've just made.
Well, I appreciate that. But, you know, I wrote a paper on this when I was in college, and I can tell you I did no small amount of research on this.
You need to do a Lincoln. Whole program on that, on Lincoln, because most people believe that Lincoln was an incredible president. And I really think you really need to do a whole program on that.
It doesn't take much of a historian to realize that under his watch, more Americans died at battle than any other war we fought.
But I don't want to cut it short, but I just want to let you know that as far as I'm concerned, as far as my perspective, my reality, that the people of Egypt are doing everything that they should be doing. All right, they are not rebels. They are not. They are what America should be doing with getting all the press that they possibly can get, without the negativity. I didn't want to leave. I wanted to be part of that protest. And it was, and William Henry said, "Diane, you cannot do that." I just have to tell you that I didn't see any of the negativity that is being shown on our propaganda news network.
The Muslim Brotherhood in the past has effectively resisted the Al-Qaeda. And they're probably one of the oldest, being established in 1928, I think. One of the oldest Muslim organizations out there, and they're one of the biggest. It's a Shia. I think it's either Shiite or maybe it is Shiite. Maybe it's Sunni. I can't remember now. But
it's a Shiite.
Okay, Shiite sect, but they have effectively resisted Al-Qaeda, and they have been somewhat of a stabilizing force. But what is the leadership? I mean, is the leadership anti-American, as we're hearing in the news?
No, it is not. Actually, everywhere I went in Egypt, and we went from the very north to the south, or as they reverse it from, because in Egypt it's the opposite. north is south and south is north. So Upper Egypt and Lower Egypt are absolutely the reverse. But everywhere I went, they just welcomed the American people, and I never once, and I talked to so many people, and they were so lovely and so gracious. And when this all started, you know, and I was, I said, you know, don't let go. Go for freedom. Go for what you feel in your heart. Just go for it. And they all agreed. And I got to tell you something, Brooks. It was it just warmed my heart that this 23-year-old girl started this all on Facebook.
Yeah, isn't that cool? That's why they shut the internet down. And we suspect that's why.
That's why we couldn't get out. I mean, I was supposed to get out. I didn't get out till Wednesday, and because we couldn't get on the internet, we couldn't make contact with anybody. They even shut the landlines down.
I couldn't even get a wake-up call in my room. That's funny. But that's cool. I mean, you were involved, and I love this report, Diane. And yes, I will do a special on Lincoln, and I'll invite you back on the program. We'll talk about it.
Thank you very much, Brooks. Have a good evening, and I hope to see you at James Gillen's place in the summer.
In July. Absolutely. Thanks so much, Diane. Thanks so much for the report. Welcome back.
Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right, we're going to take a quick break. We're running long. Let's go ahead and take a quick four-minute breather. We'll just listen to some music, get something cool to drink. By the way, Steelers have the ball. They are a field goal away from tying it up. I think this Super Bowl is going into overtime. We'll be back after this. you would like to be part of tonight's program, you can call us at 530-413-4511. 530-413-4515.
I know it's pretty hard to turn off that Packers-Steelers Super Bowl game right now. The Steelers have the ball, and they are one field goal away from tying it up. If the Packers can stop them, it looks like the game came out as predicted, but Steelers are pretty effective, and they're pretty determined, and they could tie it up. In our last hour here on Expert Radio, my good friend Diane, we have known for a couple of years, just returned from Egypt, spending a couple of weeks there with William Henry on one of his tours. And by the way, if you haven't been to Egypt and you want to take in everything, you want to see those temples one right after the other and you want to hear what they're about, I highly recommend William Henry's tour in January of each year. The weather is very agreeable for Westerners. It's, you know, mid-50s, low-60s. Terrible for Egyptians. They just hate that cold weather, and occasionally it may even rain. But you'll get to see a lot. It's sort of like going to Disneyland when it's lightly raining. You can ride all the rides. That's the way it is in Egypt, too. When it's cool like that, you can make a lot out of a little. And it's not very expensive, and you'd really enjoy yourself. If you want to take a little bit something more off the beaten path, something not touristy, then you might consider going with John Riley and myself. We'll be putting together another Egypt trip here before too long. We had a small group with us the last time that we went. I did not get to participate in it. I had to go to China on business, but I did return back to Cairo and spent, I think, the last 3 days with them. But I next time, I promise you, we're going on the Dalabeya. That's the ship that sails the Nile. It is quite luxurious, and you can stop wherever you want to stop and see what you want to see. These are the small boats, not the large tourist ships that only stop at the tourist traps. This is a small ship, so you can really enjoy the stars at night by sleeping out on the deck. And we tend to go in the fall instead of the middle of winter, so it's a little bit more pleasant. That being said, the report is, and this is right from the streets of Cairo, the report is that we have been fed a load of malarkey. Our news organizations in this country are acting like propagandists, and they are not telling us the truth. What is going on over there is not only extremely peaceful, but the people are very excited and they're very inspired that they are actually demanding a new government, one that can provide them with basic welfare, like clean water, and redo the tax system. You know, if you ever go to Cairo and you ever drive the surrounding area, you'll be surprised because there's a lot of construction that has been done in the last 25 years. None of it's finished. Do you know why it's not finished? You know why there are not windows in the door, in the openings? Why there are not doors on the doorways? Why there's rebar sticking out of the top of the buildings? Because as soon as they're finished, they're taxed heavily. And so the people, in order to avoid tax, won't finish the construction. And so what you have is an entire country full of unfinished construction. And it's a terrible, terrible comment on what should be a modern, vibrant country, a city with 20 million people in it, cars and donkeys and camels and trucks and motorcycles and carts, and not a single stoplight or stop sign anywhere. That being said, I guess the traffic management system seems to work pretty well because they don't have many accidents, although you do see a lot of cars with dents on them. All right, let's go back to the phones. Looks like we have Loris from Texas on line one. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Dr. Brooks.
Hi, how are you?
Good. I'm going to change the subject just a little bit.
Sure.
I have been going over some old-time radio. It's kind of, it's more recent than some, but these, the it's called the CBS Radio Mystery Theater, and it went from 1974 to 1982. And the thing that strikes me about this is that the topics that they treated and, like, the kind of the higher understandings which they dealt with, a lot of them, it wasn't just speculation. I mean, a lot of the things that they proposed within the storylines were things that we have come to understand, you know, in more modern times. And I think that's pretty interesting. There's this one particular person who they did about four episodes from his case files in 1978, most of them were. His name is Bryce Bond. And he amazed me because he dealt with reincarnation for, you know, like past life regression for healing. One episode was about communication with somebody that had gone down over the Bermuda Triangle about 30 years before. And then there was another one about a ghost hunt that was a lot more, you know, compassionate than I was aware of people were at that time about that kind of, about ghosts. And the one that amazed me the most probably was one about crop circles, UFOs, and ET contact all in one episode.
Oh, my gosh. And this is on the radio, right? So it's everything.
Yeah, this is on the radio, okay? And this was originally broadcast in 1978.
That's awesome. I think I think I remember listening to that. I don't remember the theme song or anything about it, but I remember the Radio Mystery Hour.
Yeah, well, I did too, but I didn't hear any of those. Like, I remember listening, hearing it some in maybe 1975, and then again more. I got to be a more regular listener again around 1980 and probably up until almost the end in 1982. But the thing that I'm sort of curious about is what happened to this guy named Bryce Bond? I can find little bits and pieces about him on the internet that sort of aren't related. There's no, like, comprehensive thing, like, on Wikipedia or anything like that. And he did all this, he was, you know, conversant with all these topics, and then he just kind of, like, disappears. Well, what's up with that?
Well, so he was a writer, right? He did scripts for
these.
He was
not the writer of these episodes at all. He was a writer, I think. I think he wrote a book, and I know that before all this started, he was a news broadcaster. But he actually went out and did these things that the episodes were about, apparently, because they said they were taken from his files.
Oh. Well, that's interesting. So do you think these were files that he put together as a reporter?
No, he participated. He actually was doing them. Like, okay, I did manage to find the account of the crop circle UFO ET thing on the internet that apparently happened to him during the Warminster thing in England in 1974. And it was what actually happened to him very closely followed the, or, you know, paralleled the episode that was written. They changed it up a little bit, because in the episode he's not the one that had the experience, somebody else did, but actually it happened to him, according to what I read on the internet. So the things that they presented, he actually had participated in.
That's fascinating.
He was born in 1928, so he could have made his transition, but there's almost nothing about him that's comprehensive, or that's, you know, just a little smattering here or there that doesn't really lead you anywhere. Tons of dead ends. I'm just really curious about what happened to this guy, because, you know, it seemed to me like he should be somebody like Brad Steiger or Timothy Green Beckley or somebody like that, you know, from where he was at that time.
Well, so he was like a real life X-File guy.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, that's interesting. And, you know, in those days, and if you didn't get a connection with some kind of media, whether it's radio or television, you weren't really known. I mean, there was no internet back then. In fact, we didn't have internet.
Right, that's true.
The mid-90s.
And he did. He must have worked really closely with Ian Martin, the guy who wrote those episodes, because I think Ian wrote them all, I think. I'll have to go back and check that, but I'm pretty sure he did, because Bryce actually acted in some of them.
Oh, wow. So he, yeah. So he was really
a technical. And he had to be working really closely with Ian Martin, who was another really wise, evolved person. He wrote a lot of the episodes for that whole thing, and he was really evolved, too. But he, you know, those two had to have been working closely together to have come up with this and put it all together in such a way. But, I mean, he was really, you know, he had done all this stuff, and then it was presented this way. So if you wanted to, you could pretend it was fiction, but if you really listen, they told you clearly it wasn't.
Yeah, well, I mean, how many people think that Star Wars is fiction?
Right, I know.
Or Star Trek. I mean, really, the path that we travel scientifically is pretty close to the path that we travel science fictionally.
I've noticed that too, and I think it's, you know, I think it's because science and spirit are not really separate.
Well, that's true, and you know, we manifest what we think about. Those things that we think about, we eventually do, and those things that we do, you know, affect the universe. That's why I say everything we do will eventually affect the universe. But when you have an explorer like Bryce Bond, and I'm sure he wasn't alone. There were others that did it as well.
Oh, yeah.
But
I don't know about him. That's amazing. Yeah,
he did something with it. That's why you know about it. He affected your universe.
Yeah, exactly.
So, you know, we've been talking about pole shifts and Earth changes from a pretty much scientific point of view, but I think that Steve kind of broached on the idea that, you know, some of this scientific exploration that we're doing and that we're talking about doing is also going to have some very profound, shall we call it, anthropological effects in the sense that mankind is going to wake up as a race. And, you know, Diane was just on and said, you know what they're doing in Egypt, we need to do here. I just heard that. I was watching Glenn Beck.
Yeah, I heard that. Yeah. A lot of people have been saying it too, and when you hear them talk about it, you know, like I heard the night that William Henry called in on Coast to Coast, and they were still, I think, at the Cairo airport. And the inspiration, the passion, the excitement in his voice was just, you know, I'm glad I heard that, because what's going on over there is so it's inspiring the rest of the world. You know, it's like to wake up and see what's really going on and take your place among the people who are actually making these changes happen.
Yeah. And, you know, it's a risk, because the interesting thing is that when the army showed up, the people said, oh, finally, the army showed up. Glad you guys are here. Because it was actually the police that were shooting people. That's where the 300 deaths came
from.
Yeah,
that's what I heard, too. I heard the military wouldn't shoot anyone, you know, any of the people. And I was just laughing because over here, oh boy, if we ever had the military over here, it would be different.
Well, you know, the interesting thing, and I was trying to cover this with Diane, 37 states have passed sovereignty acts. What people don't realize is that 5 more states and we now have enough for a constitutional convention.
Wow, that's great. Only 5 more states? Because
that's
I was
correct.
Thinking,
once,
you know,
once you
I've
hit,
heard about that before, about the states that have passed those.
Two-thirds.
Those
that's
acts.
Right. Tennessee
is, really
just did it like 2 weeks ago.
Oh.
So it's a groundswell, because when these governors do this, these are constitutional declarations that once there's 42 states, two-thirds of the nation, they can then call a constitutional convention and they can ratify sweeping changes, which means we can get rid of things like the EPA, the DOE, the Department of Energy, Education, the Food and Drug
what about
Administration.
The IRS?
Yeah, the IRS, you can fire the IRS, go to a flat national tax, like a VAT tax.
Yeah.
You can. We can make sweeping changes because we, the people, as a supermajority, have risen up and made a decision. That's it. No Congress, no Senate, no president can usurp it. That's a constitutional convention.
I did not know that.
Yeah, that's, you know, yeah. One of the things that we do here
that's,
is
that that's we, what we need to be doing. It really is.
Hey, well, we started right here on X Squared Radio.
Thanks a lot.
Happy to participate.
Talk to you later.
All right. Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right. Well, that's interesting. Part of science is political science. And I don't mean that you're going to get a lot of propaganda here because that's not what we do. But we do discover in the mysteries of the universe and the earth. And one of the mysteries of this earth right now is our political scientific condition. It is, in a word, deplorable. It is, in another word, completely detached from reality. What you see on the news, what you see on C-SPAN, is nothing, nothing like the reality of what you would call government. Many people see this, many people realize this, but they don't say much about it. If you go to Washington, spend some time there, go to the Capitol Convention Center, okay, right underground, right adjacent to the Capitol building, is a series of auditoriums, very secure. The last time I was there with several hundred constituents from my home state, all of the congressmen from my home state, all eight, representatives of the government, governor's office, and we went before Secretary of Transportation and others in other cabinet organizations, and we made the case for our state, for North Carolina, for a business perspective. This was the annual business summit, and my company was invited to come there and make a presentation, which we did. Now, the interesting thing was that what we thought, because of all of the propaganda that we get over various things like FedConnect and CCR, CCR is a central contractors organization through which the government lets contracts out to private companies. And, of course, we're members of that, and we're members of FedConnect. And so we get to look at all the opportunities, and we have applied many, many times for grants and loans and loan guarantees and never been granted anything. So in frustration, we joined a contingency and were invited to Washington and went and made a presentation. And what we discovered was what was in print, what was being publicized to the people, was not just a lie. It wasn't just a falsehood. It wasn't just deception. It was a well-laid plan to dismantle and destroy small business in America, because it is small business that really drives the entrepreneurial spirit in this country. The entire system had been set up to subvert small business, to gut it, to remove all hopes of funding, and if they had any funds in the bank, to go after those in the form of application fees and costs and all kinds of financial hurdles that you have to cross that have nothing to do with producing the product, safe or otherwise. And yet here it was in your face, set up just like that. And what is happening in Egypt is the only thing the people can do, because they cannot vote. Oh, sure, they can go pull the handle. They can put their X in the box. They can fill the boxes with ballots, overwhelmingly throwing their government out. And what happens to their ballots? They're burned. They're shredded. They're destroyed. And year after year, the same government is elected over and over again. And finally, the people said, enough is enough. It's time for you to have a new zip code, Mubarak, and those of your cronies. And we might be in that same position now in the United States. Now, I honestly don't think we would ever be organized enough as a nation to do something like that. Facebook, Twitter, tell me another one. As if we can't even get organized to go down and have a rally at a local park. Believe me, the America is filled with apathetic, fat, lazy people who think the government owes them a living. Filled with them to the brim. And they're not going to get organized and go out and march like that. But the state legislatures, that's a different story. These are local politicians. These are local public servants. These are people that live and work in your neighborhood, and they came from your local schools. They own homes in your local districts. And the state legislatures are where the real government occurs. At the state level, that's where government works. That's where schools are paid for. That's where school buses are bought. That's where city parks are maintained. That's where medical care is taken care of for each state, state by state. Insurance is regulated. Communications by cell phone and telephone. Banking is regulated. Everything at the state level. And when these governors and local legislators get together and they pass a sovereignty act, that means we are the United States of Mississippi. We are the United States of Texas. We are the United and Sovereign State of South Carolina, North Carolina, New York, New Hampshire, Vermont, Iowa, Idaho, Montana, California. We are the United States of that state. And we are not going to enact federal unfunded mandates that are thrown on our state until they are ratified by our state legislature. Now that is an act of sedition. That is an act of secession, okay? Secession from the Union is what caused the Civil War. Well, no, actually, that's a false statement. Secession from the Union is what gave the president the excuse of marshaling Union forces and invading the South and ending up, because he couldn't win, burning cities to the ground, burning and salting fields, destroying, beating the South down to the point, like the Treaty of Versailles, you set yourself up for another such conflict. Reconstruction was an act of intimidation and blackmail to force states to sign back into the Union. Texas never signed. Other states are following. Five more states, 42 states, and we now have a majority of the states of the United States. And they can then call a constitutional convention, and they can make sweeping changes, not in the Constitution, a return to the Constitution, a return to constitutional government. That is what the people might rise up and do. The main thing to consider, the main thing is the main thing, no leader. No leader, no charismatic leader that stands up and says, I am the leader, I am the voice of this new government. Nonsense. This is a government by people, for people, and the republic is broken. And the republic needs to be put back together. And the republic is a representative government with three functional branches in it, not one, which is what we have right now. We have one functioning branch of government, and it's made up of two guys joined at the hip. And the interesting thing is, neither one of them are the brains behind the organization. The brains are somewhere else. The money is somewhere else. And the orders are coming from somewhere else. So, the important thing is that this needs to be a leaderless movement. It needs to be a united front, like a tsunami of people and consciousness. Not one person that can be killed or obfuscated. So, by the way, in the news, Tehran, as described by Iran's leaders, the uprising in Egypt has served as vindication of their country's Islamic revolution 32 years ago. But for the opposition here, the scenes on the streets of Cairo have brought stark reminders of their own unfinished quest for political reform. The divergent narratives illustrate the deep divide that separates President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad and his supporters from a struggling opposition movement made up of middle-class urbanites and politicians who were pushed from power. They also underscore the uncertainty over whether, over where events in Egypt all will lead. Now, the interesting thing is, what we're hearing in our propaganda, in the United States, our propaganda, is that the Muslim Brotherhood is trying to establish an Islamic State and they are preparing for war against Israel. Yes, yes, absolutely. I heard it my own self out of the lips of Glenn Beck just last night. Those exact words. The Muslim Brotherhood is establishing an Islamic State with the express purpose of going to war with Israel. Now, I've just talked to my friends who returned from there. They just got back 2 days ago. You heard her call in and say, these people have nothing of the sort on their minds. They don't want to go to war. They don't want to fight anybody. What they want is clean water. What they want are schools for their children. What they want is what government should provide for the people. Okay? Egypt has plenty of money. Egypt is a huge supplier of natural gas. Egypt is a huge supplier of tourism. And I gotta tell you, that is so poorly run, you cannot imagine how poorly run it is. It is Egypt's greatest resource, and yet it is handled like a vacant lot. It's horrible, and it could be so beautiful. It could be so awesome, and the world would come from all over the planet to see the ancient relics and buildings and special technologies that are just laying there in the sand. There are whole cities that have not even been excavated yet. Whole cities, stuff nobody has seen for thousands of years. Are you crazy? It's a wonderful resource. Millions and millions and millions of tourists would pour into that area, would pour billions of money into Egypt. And Egypt could be wealthy, like Kuwait. Egypt could be wealthy. And that's what those people want. They don't want to go to war with Israel. That's nuts. That's just propaganda. The United States doesn't want to go to war with anybody. We just want less government. We want to go to work, and we want to keep the money that we make. We are paying 50 to 60% in taxes. Can I see a show of hands out there of everyone who believes that they are withholding some money from the government? Let me put it another way. I want to see a show of hands of people who don't report all their income to the federal government. Ah, ha, ha, ha. See, that's what I'm talking about. Now, a lot of you make W-2 income. That means that your employer takes the money out of your check without your permission and sends it into the government. And then at the end of the year, you file your taxes, and you get back what the government borrowed from you interest-free, if you're lucky, if you can make your way through all the paperwork. That's maybe, maybe all your income. But I bet it's not. I bet you worked on a car in your garage. I bet you painted a house or cut somebody's hair or did somebody's lawn. I bet you made $50 here, $100 there. I bet you made money during the summer, cash only. Did you report it? No, you didn't. Here's the thing about it. The original income tax law is hard to even explain. I'm not going to go into it. So many tax protests have been out there, and they have all failed because the IRS is one of the most powerful and feared organizations in the history of the world. But it's no match for a constitutional convention. Once that 16th Amendment is washed from the books, it's gone, people. It's gone. Constitutional or unconstitutional makes no difference. Once a constitutional convention is formed and an amendment is annulled, that's it. No more income tax. There's no argument about it. There's no basis in law for it to exist any longer. And the time has come for kings and tyrannical rulers to step down. Because if they don't, we have a system in this country. It was organized hundreds of years ago, and it will work. It's designed to work. Is it easy? No, it isn't easy. That's why we have the oldest, most stable constitution in the world. We have a constitution that other constitutions are actually based upon. It is based on certain inalienable rights, and they have been alienated. They have been alienated, and it is time to set the record back where it needs to be. It is time to change the course of this country. We are not ruled. We are governed. There's a big difference. Can I see a show of hands of all those that feel they're being governed and not ruled by the White House? Yeah, well, either your arms are tired out there or you believe what I'm saying is true. We are being ruled, not governed. So, the proper way for government to raise revenue is through tariffs. The proper way for government to raise revenue is to levy a tax against businesses that make a profit, not against individuals who work for wages. That is not the government's responsibility, nor its right. Now, that being said, the government can legally levy sales taxes. That is in the Constitution. And so they could levy a flat tax, a flat 8%, 9%, 10%. It could be 20%. It doesn't matter what it is. That's the constitutional way to raise revenue. Now, there are two advantages and a whole bunch of disadvantages. Here are the two advantages. Number one, steady income all year long. You don't have to wait to the end of the year when people pay their taxes. You don't have to wait quarterly for these kinds of reports. You get income all year long. The second main advantage is that the revenue is directly linked to the gross national product. The more the country produces, the more revenue the country makes. Wow, what a great feedback system. Now, here are the negatives from a ruler's point of view. Not a government, but a ruler's point of view. The negative is you can't control the classes. You can't pit the poor against the rich. You can't manipulate the middle class into voting the way you want them to vote. You can't take the elderly and scare the hell out of them. If they don't vote Democratic, they're going to lose their Social Security check. Horse manure. That kind of class manipulation is why we are ruled by the people that we have supposedly elected into office. We are not a ruled people. We are a represented people. This is a republic. And when we elect people to go to Washington, they don't tell us what to do. We tell them what to do. They go to Washington and they do our bidding, not the other way around. They don't go to Washington and make laws to move us around. They go to Washington to make laws to make our lives better. I elected them and sent them there to do that. It seems like, no, it doesn't seem like. It is, it has become an organization of talking heads and bureaucracies that rule over us. And that, my friends, comes to an end right now. Five more states. Do some research on your own. When we come back next week, we'll have a little bit more information on it. Do some research on your own. Find out if your state has not passed a sovereignty act. If they haven't, why don't you consider writing a letter? Why don't you consider writing 4,000 letters? Why don't you consider writing 100,000 letters? Not to the federal government, but to your state legislature. Write to the chief of staff of the governor. He's listed on the website, or she. Find out who that person is and write them a letter and tell them you want your state to pass a resolution of sovereignty. Five more states, people, and we can do a constitutional convention. 10 more states, and it would be irrefutable. If we could get all 50 states to do it, by the way, the District of Columbia is a sovereign country, and they don't rule this country. Okay? Washington, D.C., the District of Columbia. All 50 states request a constitutional convention. It can be done, and it must be done. Now, of course, one of the other main advantages of what's called a consumption tax or a use tax is you would generate far more revenue, maybe orders of magnitude more revenue than you do right now. Why? Because everybody is drawn into the tax system. Come on, people. People that make over $300,000-$400,000 a year, they don't pay any taxes. People that make $50 million a year, $100 million a year, they don't pay a penny in income tax. It all goes into foundations and nonprofits. Their costs are covered because houses are provided for them. Cars are owned by companies. Land is owned by companies. They don't pay any income tax. Don't fool yourself. These wealthy people travel around from condo to condo, home to home, cars, airplanes, boats. They don't pay any income tax. But I guarantee you they would pay the tax if there was a value-added tax. Because they buy more than poor people, and so they would pay more tax. Also, all the illegal aliens that are in this country, they don't pay a penny in income tax because they don't have Social Security numbers. They don't pay a dime, not even a nickel, not even a fraction of a penny. But they would pay if there was a national sales tax because they buy stuff. How about all the people that work for cash, the whole subculture of cash? Millions of Americans work for cash under the table. They work as shade tree mechanics. They have a beauty shop in their home. They cater. They walk dogs. They do all kinds of stuff for cash. They don't pay any income tax. But they would if there was a national sales tax. You see, you would pull tens of millions of more people into the revenue system than we currently have. Right now, the middle class pays all the taxes. The wealthy pay, what's considered not the wealthy, but the rich. Okay, there's a difference. Shaq is rich. The guy that signs Shaq's check, he's wealthy. The wealthy don't pay any taxes, but the rich do. The ones that make hundreds of thousands of dollars a year, they pay 90% of the taxes. The rest is paid by the middle class, and the poor pay nothing. Well, they do pay because they buy lottery tickets, which is just a tax on the poor and the stupid, which is why I agree with it. I think it's a wonderful idea because it's voluntary. I don't have to pay, so I don't play. I don't succumb to any of that advertising. All right. Sorry I got off on a tangent. We started with magnetic pole shifts, and we ended up talking about another kind of pole. We'll see you right here on X Squared Radio next week. Thank you. Thank you, my friends, especially for the wonderful emails about reading the book or listening to the audiobook, Remembering the Future, The Physics of the Soul and Time Travel. If you picked up a copy, tell a friend. Be happy to box up some more, sign them, and send them out. We're ready to go when you are. We'll see you next week. It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station, and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio saying, peace, Earth Explorers.